Hello, I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
And this is a Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
podcast.
Welcome back to the podcast. Just going to dive straight in today. Top line, there's been a budget, has there not, Caroline?
Yeah.
You're going to talk about that.
Can't wait.
I'm going to talk about money laundering.
A different kind of budgeting, perhaps?
Well, you know. Midlife crisis, you have to think about diversifying your income streams, don't you? But more on that later. And Claire, you're going to catch up on something from last week.
Yep, just a little bit more detail about the Every Woman in Tech Awards that we went to after the forum.
So, Caroline, there was a budget this week and it was the first budget for the new man.
Yes, as I'm billing it, the most highly anticipated government fiscal event of spring 2020.
Whoa.
And yeah, it happened this week. But yes, as ever, it was an all-hands-on-deck affair for the extended Computer Weekly editorial team. So we had Liz Evanstad, our public sector editor. She returned from maternity leave on the very day that she came back. We made her
sit down
and cover the budget. Just feel so sorry for her. Like, just like, hey, welcome back here. Do loads of work. Do punishing work where it's just announcement after an announcement thrown at you and make sense of it within, like, no time at all and write it. It's just...
Yeah.
Just
in the deep end.
Yeah, so it was a big event, this one. As you said, Brian, it's the first one delivered by the new Chancellor. But also, it's the first one from the new government. There's quite a lot of hype around it, because it's going to provide a bit of a first look at what the new government's sort of spending priorities are going to be, and that kind of thing. Particularly, you know, with Brexit on the horizon, you know, we're in the middle of a climate crisis. There's lots of hope and anticipation there'd be a few sort of green tech announcements in it as well. So yeah, there was lots of anticipation as well that the government might use it to sort of flesh out what its financial strategy is going to be around addressing the coronavirus outbreaks as well. There was some of that. So without going too much into the detail of it, because there are other publications who will do a much better job of that than me and us. So yeah, there was announced a £30 billion package of measures that are designed to sort of support the UK economy through all of this, yeah.
Where did they get that money?
Well, this is the thing. Everyone's like, oh, for, you know, years and years we were told by Theresa May there's no magic money tree.
Yeah,
but suddenly it's like,
money tree?
Here you go. Here
it was in her garden the whole time.
Yeah.
They are going to so borrow. They are borrowing.
Yeah.
Like there's no tomorrow.
Who are they borrowing
government?
From?
The international borrowing providing institutions and whatnot.
Is that just
I don't know.
A bigger money tree somewhere else?
Just shake it.
Yeah.
The thing is, interest rates are really low. So they're saying, well, you know, why not? That's a good time to borrow.
I can think of
so they're saying what Labour has been saying for a long time.
Yeah, right. But I think they've just got no choice, have they? It was just weird.
Not much.
Like I say, with Brexit,
yeah.
You've got this very unexpected, no one predicted infectious outbreak on the horizon as well.
Yeah,
and it's just sort of like, well, you're going to need money, so where do you get it from? You can't just rely on, oh, we've been, you know, saving and austerity and all that sort of stuff. Like, yeah, but something's cropped up now, so it's time to whack out a credit card and start borrowing.
Fair enough.
Oh, it is Rishi Sunak's first budget. I mean, imagine that, 4 weeks into a job.
Yeah, being able to be like, boom, 30 mil, 30 bill.
Yeah, just like, just dropped it. Just like, where did you find it? Just something I was working
money
on.
True, bitch.
Yeah. But, yeah. Thing is, though, that's 30 billion for that. There was the 22 billion funding commitment they made around supporting research and development activities that will, the government promises, make the UK a leader in innovation.
Which, yay!
Which I'm pretty sure we have heard that a lot.
We have.
It sounds very like, okay, yeah.
It's coping with Brexit, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
It must be.
Well, I said, like, because I looked at Liz's story, like her write-up of it all, where obviously, like I said, she watched the announcements live and then she dug into the sort of the budget book as well. And I was just like, what is this? So he said that this $22 billion is the fastest and largest increase in R&D spend ever. And they're going to use it to invest in ideas.
Ideas.
Because the government doesn't have any? So we're just going to invest in ideas.
Oh, that's interesting.
This does sound like kind of maybe indirectly Brexit, in that he's saying that this is the highest, as a percentage of GDP, it's the highest amount of increase in R&D spend in 40 years, nearly 4 years, and it's higher than the US is spending, it's more than China's spending, it's more than France and Japan. I don't know why France got singled out, but yeah, I hope France is okay with that. We're spending more than any of those countries, which does feel a bit like sort of, you know, UK, we're going to be all right on our own, Brexit, like we're spending more than you, all you guys, like we don't need you, kind of thing. It did have maybe bits of that.
Yeah, spending money we don't have.
Yeah, but he said, you know, the success in the global economy will be rooted in innovation and cutting-edge technology. But you are kind of like, what ones? Name
them. Where are these cutting-edge technologies?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I had an idea the other day.
So, yeah, so a lot of it is a bit like, okay, that's fine. But, yeah, his vagueness did continue a bit. So he was like, oh, we're going to invest that money in people, ideas, and industries.
Right.
That will cement, he said, the UK's world-leading position in science and technologies. Ranging from nuclear fusion to electric vehicles and life sciences. Yeah. So you're just, okay, fine, but still some detail, please. But it's like, no, on to the next bit. Like,
yeah.
We're announcing something else now. So that's what budgets are like. You never quite get...
You can't deep dive into any of the specific things.
Yeah, and that's, yeah, that's
because
the whole thing.
It's very, like, high level. I don't know, maybe they know something that we don't. Maybe they know that the apocalypse is coming and money's not going to mean anything when
it
comes.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, there's lots of a few recycled announcements as well. So there was something about the government reiterating its commitment to spending £5 billion on broadband and sort of connectivity, which you know we need, which we'll increasingly need once everyone has to work from home because of coronavirus.
Yeah.
So is that? And what else was there? Oh, there was something. There wasn't huge amounts of detail on this, but it sounded quite interesting. That the government's going to create a new funding agency who, according to Liz, their main focus will be high-risk and high-reward research.
Probably artificial intelligence type stuff, which is quite risky, maybe.
Maybe we'll have to wait and see.
What's the biggest risk?
Killer
robots are a bit of a risk with the old AI, aren't they?
Yeah,
like
really biased robots. You know, the ones that we've been saying, oh, they shouldn't be biased. Are these absolute like bastard,
like
biased,
nasty robots?
Yeah, those
all
guys.
Over the internet.
Yeah,
escapes out the back door, and now they live in the code on Twitter.
Yeah, high risk, high reward though. That might do some good for someone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there was one other thing as well, which, like I said, the budget was covered by lots of different people on the team. So our colleague, Sebastian Klobig-Skelton, he picked up on another announcement that was made, which is around the government's decision to create a digital markets task force, which will be overseen by representatives from the Competition and Markets Authority, the ICO and Ofcom, so basically three different regulators. So, but as with all of these things, Digital Markets Task Force, what does that actually mean? What are those words? I know what digital means, I know what markets are. Task Force, but what do those three words mean together?
Why?
Yeah, so again, it's like one of these things, like I said, they make the announcement and then it's like, oh, here's some detail, bye, moving on to the next thing. But apparently these regulators are going to join forces to do something that I think we've written quite a lot about sort of similar efforts along these lines, which is they're going to look at how digital platforms and advertising markets should be regulated to sort of encourage competition and avoid monopolies forming. Mm. Yeah, there's been lots of like initiatives like that, I think, on an EU sort of level, trying to stop kind of, like I say, the whole digital platforms, like what digital platforms exactly? Like that
is that,
covers,
you know, like e-commerce or is that social media or is that, I don't know.
Exactly.
Like
advertising
it's usually
markets.
A code for social media.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to say Facebook.
Mm.
They don't want to say LinkedIn. Amazon, etc. So Google, actually, as well.
I was going to say advertising markets could be Google because they control a lot of advertising. I don't think it's any surprise. I'm digging into Sebastian's article on this. They said the work of this task force is going to be led from... sort of, they'll be encouraged to make use of sort of domestic regulations that already exist around this stuff, but also borrow from the EU as well. I'm like, can't do that, Brexit. Like, don't copy their homework, do your own. But apparently we're going to do that, so that's fine. They've been told this task force that they've got 6 months to get their act together and report back to the government on the work they're doing. So, I guess it's like, we've announced it, there'll be more detail in 6 months, more of the story to tell then, and we'll see whether or not it's just another one of those, like I say, we hear about initiatives like this quite a lot, so is it just going to be another initiative you hear about and just when the next one's announced.
Gets re-announced and stuff.
Yeah, so we'll see.
And then they're like, we had to cancel it because the first four meetings were about what we were actually doing. Or like, what are we and what's a digital market?
Yeah, do we go by DMT? Do we have an acronym or are we very much always digital markets task? I don't know, coffee break, more biscuits, and then we'll come back to this after the break.
Yeah, but which biscuits shall we get in?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're the important things. You have to hammer out, really. You've got to get the basics right before you get on with the real work.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like most budgets, though, these always fill up like those reasons. They always feel a bit like an anti-climax. Like you hear all this huge sums of money being chucked around. And, you know, they are sort of long-term sort of commitments and stuff. So you don't always see, like, an immediate return. So it always just feels like, oh, we've done a budget, they've chucked some money here, there we go. And then you kind of forget, like, has anything been done on this? Or, you know, and that's it, really. So, yeah, like I said, it's a huge bit of work covering it all. And they do make technology announcements and cover it and stuff like that. But, yeah, it's always a bit kind of, oh, what now? And they've announced it all.
Yeah.
And there was and on the IR35 stuff, a lot of people were hoping that would be either a delay announced for IR35 is not coming into force and stuff like that. So there was quite a bit of upset that the new Chancellor did not mention IR35 during his speech at all. And then the actual budget book just said, yeah, it's going ahead as planned. So so there was a few kind of contracting stakeholder groups, the Freelancer and Contractor Services Association were the CEO of that had some quite strong words to say, but it felt like an insult to all the people who have over the last few months sort of protested and raised concerns about this legislation. They didn't even mention it during the speech, and none of it's been listened to.
There'll be another budget later in the year.
Autumn budget again. Like I say, they make all these huge announcements, and then you kind of think, we should follow up on what happened to their last bit of money that they announced last time. But
it can all be, you know, like a bit tricksy and difficult. Sometimes they rename stuff and you're like, I don't understand where that went or what that is, or if it's the same thing or the same people or the same money.
Yeah, our pal Matt Hancock got in trouble for that, didn't he? Because he kept announcing like nurse numbers, wasn't it? Oh, we've got X number of nurses going on the beat, and everyone's like, oh, these new nurses. I can't remember.
Oh, these during the election.
And I can't remember exactly what but yeah, everyone's like, these aren't new nurses. He's just basically announcing how many nurses there are.
Already?
Yeah. And then, bless him.
He's very prominent at the moment because of the coronavirus as well.
Yeah.
Very reassuring.
Is he?
Has he got an app for it?
Probably no comment is the best thing to say there. And also this year, there is to be the Comprehensive Spending Review, which is a 3-year budget across Whitehall. I'm not an expert on this stuff, but I think it was supposed to take place last year and it got rolled over because of Theresa May going and then the new Prime Minister, etc, etc. But our editor-in-chief, eagle-eyed, spotted an advert or a call for applications, rather, on a government website looking for a crack team of data experts to come in and do a 6-week project in March and April. $60,000 for the job.
What, for all of them or individually?
Well, for the piece of work.
Oh, okay.
And it'll probably be done by one of the consultancies, I should think. But the idea is to identify barriers to public sector data sharing and ensure better use of data for improved delivery of public services. And this might turn out to be quite an important thing. It's quite an important project. It's quite strategic. The Prince of Darkness himself, Dominic Cummings, as we know, is very keen on data and data analytics. So this could be speculating here, but could be part of his, you know, the kind of change that he's trying to introduce and kind of have a big radical transformation of Whitehall, improving their data activities, etc. But there you go, 6 weeks' work, $60,000. Applications are invited. Maybe we could do it. There's three of us.
I'm busy. But there was someone pointed out the other day that this is just a complete aside to everything. But it basically, David Cameron, if he hadn't resigned, and if we hadn't had Theresa May and everything, his original time as Prime Minister would still be running. He was like voted in for 5 years. And that just sort of blew my mind. Like, you just can't imagine, like, there's been so much change, like, over the last couple of years. He would still, oh my God, he'd still be there if he hadn't resigned. God. Just, yeah, blew my mind a little bit, so I just thought I'd share that with you.
That is a bit mind-blowing, isn't it? What is he doing? I guess he's just
he was writing his
enjoying
memoirs,
himself.
Yeah,
he's done that now.
Yeah, no one read them. no one bought them.
Yeah. Well, from financial matters at state level to what I found out this week is a massive pain point for banks and other financial institutions, which is money laundering or identifying nefarious activities that their customers might be engaged in. So a lot of events have been cancelled. Gartner data event was supposed to happen Monday, Tuesday, didn't. But one event that did go ahead was Neo4j's graph tour. So that did go ahead, and I did pop along to that very briefly. Spoke to a gentleman called Paul Westcott, who is Product Director, Customer Due Diligence at Dun & Bradstreet.
Mm.
It was quite interesting to hear him talk about this project that they've had with Neo4j, which is a graph database. Very similar use case to the Panama Papers thing. So the basic kind of problem here is it's very hard for a bank, for example, or anyone indeed, to tell who owns a company, who really owns it, who are the beneficial shareholders of a legal entity. And this has been, in financial services, has been especially a kind of an issue they've had to deal with since about 2013 when the G8 decided that there had to be a real drive to make sure that you could identify who were the true owners of shell companies and things like that. So there's been all these anti-money laundering. It's not just money laundering, because there's also the funding of terrorism and there's tax evasion, etc., etc. But money laundering, anti-money laundering directives from the EU, it's kind of again and again getting more and more stringent. And it's really hard for people working for banks to know their customer sufficiently well to appease the financial authorities. So in the UK, that would be the Financial Conduct Authority. Because what you should be able to do is to say who owns 25% plus of any company beneficially. I'll come on to that in a second. But for example, according to Paul, he's got this presentation where he talks about the five biggest UK banks have all been fined for non-compliance with anti-money laundering, so not doing a good enough job on checking their customers. Between 2012 and 2018, across Europe, £16 billion worth of fines for banks for not doing a sufficiently good job of this. The reason why it's a difficult thing to do is that you can get Company A, and it's a beneficial owner of Company C via Company B, so like a holding company, and that's quite a simple relationship. But when you multiply that over hundreds of millions of companies all over the world, and it's all offshore stuff, all of this, it's about kind of minimizing your tax exposure, etc., etc. But the basic problem for the banks is being able to say, well, who really owns this?
Mm.
Who owns this company? But thankfully, there is a solution. It's one solution.
Right.
I'm sure there are others. But basically what Dun & Bradstreet as a business information provider is doing, because they have business records for 300 million companies all over the world in 200 countries. It's all in kind of SQL databases and stuff, their information. And it's quite difficult it's very difficult actually to say who owns who when you're working on that basis. So what they've done is they've teamed up with Neo4j, who do a graph database. Now, what is a graph database, we ask ourselves? I've been asking myself that question for many, many years, but I mean, to really simplify it so I can understand it. Basically, a graph database is one where you have entities, so that could be like the three of us, and then connections between those entities. So it's a way of representing those. So you have the graph database, and then you have a data visualization tool which in their case happens to be Lincurious, to visualise, you know, those relationships. And all runs on AWS, so this is also an AWS story in terms of technology. That helps you very quickly to see, get a pretty good idea of who owns what.
Yeah, it makes it easier to make those connections between things.
It's really hard otherwise. Because otherwise, previously you've had people in banks who would like, they would phone up companies and say, who owns you?
I own me.
And they'd say, well, get noted. I'm not telling you that. Why should I tell you that?
Yeah,
but if they did that here, like, who owns you? Like, well, tech target. But if they want a name, like, I don't know who the registered owner of this event, like, of this company is. Like, I don't know. It depends who you get through to.
And we are a legitimate business.
We are, yeah, we definitely are.
Think how even more difficult it is when you have criminals setting up companies or tax avoiders setting up all sorts of a real tangled web of companies. And just coming back to David Cameron, of course, his father got caught up in the Panama Papers thing.
Was the money just resting in his account? Was that that's what the father said.
It was an offshore. It was an offshore company. He was the family was a beneficiary of, and so on. And that's all very, very well documented. But yeah, so I mean, some of the examples that Paul gave, just to kind of make it kind of user friendly, was like Chelsea Football Club. Who owns that? If you go to Company's House, it's owned by Ford's Dram Limited, but really we all know it's owned by Roman Abramovich. He's the beneficial owner.
Yeah.
Of that, of Chelsea Football Club and many other things besides. But I mean, that's a kind of, and we all know this because we all know who Roman Abramovich is and he owns Chelsea, but for the examples that banks are having to deal with, it's really hard.
Yeah, because they're not going to be high profile public facing companies necessarily, they're all just whoever really.
And Paul recommended a book to read, and I have a
it so happens
that I had this book anyway, and if you'll forgive me, I'll just read. This is Moneyland by Oliver Bullock. And there's just a little paragraph here that I think is quite, really illustrates quite well the problem here. So he talks about, he's in London, I guess. So the place I get my haircut is owned in Gibraltar. A building site on my way to the train station is owned in the Isle of Man, etc., etc. It's a real kind of rabbit hole type thing. And he calls this new world Moneyland, which is the name of the book. Maltese passports, English libel, American privacy, Panamanian shell companies, Jersey trusts, Liechtenstein foundations, all added together to create a virtual space that is far greater than the sum of their parts. And that's where an awful lot of dirty money lives. I think it's really interesting though. I mean, that whole kind of shadowy, murky. We started the year off with the podcast with the Sodino Kibi guys and what they were up to. And there'll be the money from some of their activities will end up in this shadowy parallel realm. But it was the only event that was open to me this week, and I went along and got to hear all about that. And what Paul said, quite a kind of cute thing, I think. He said that expressed it like this, like, because data is very boring.
He said that to you. That's your, like, you know, you love data, Dr. Data.
But it is also phenomenally interesting if you have the right tech and you have.
If you have the understanding.
Yeah, and he said that quite often when he's presenting this stuff to other members of Dun & Bradstreet or to potential customers, or to customers, they're always sitting back in their chair to begin with. And then, but then when you, when they see the visualizations that show who owns what, they immediately lean forward. And that's when he knows that he's got them.
It's like digital storytelling though, isn't it? Data visualization.
Yeah.
Yeah, so data visualization, if you think of it as like digital storytelling, because it's picking out the bit that's actually interesting and then making it appealing through colours and
brings the story to life a bit more rather than
it does bring it to life. And he talked about the daisy visualization they have, and this is not something that they drew up, but it just came out of the data itself. So I'm not going to be able to do justice to this, but it's like the petals on a daisy. Because what they find is that there are companies who actually own themselves.
What?
So they parcel out their ownership 10%, 10%, 10%, 10%, and then they come back. So they, you know, they spread the ownership to obfuscate.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I see.
Who owns what? But it renders itself as a daisy because it's coming back, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah.
He certainly thought was kind of cool.
Mm.
Ultimately, it's all quite murky stuff. I mean, they're not into the financial crime stuff, which I suppose the police will be using this sort of technology.
Yeah.
Security services and so on. So, Claire, can you raise our spirits a little bit to awards for fabulous people?
I can certainly try.
So criminally fabulous women.
So good, it's bad. I know that Claire and I spoke about that Every Woman in Tech forum that we went to last week. We spent quite a lot of time talking about some of the themes that we saw there. And then we had a mention to Claire's blue dessert at the Every Woman in Tech Awards dinner.
And her wine.
But I just thought that I could talk a little bit more about the Every Woman Awards in general. It was set up about 10 years ago, the Every Woman in Tech Awards. So there's been 10 years of awarding fabulous women with the recognition that they deserve for the amazing job that they do in technology. As always, the Every Woman Awards is kind of a light to be shone on some of the people that are in the minority in the industry, mainly because if you think of people who decide not to go into tech, one of the main reasons that is often cited is that there's a lack of role models. And then there's that quote that floats around quite a lot, and I can't remember who originally said it, but you can't be who you can't see. So making role models more visible and more accessible means that other people can sort of see a direction to go in if they think that that might be a viable career path for them. Which is the same with, you know, like our list of the top 50 women in UK tech as well. It's always good to have those people recognised for the job that they do that they might not otherwise be seen for because they're in the minority. So there were quite a lot of categories. I'm not going to read out all of the winners because there is a story on the website where you can go and have a look at all of these women and what they've done. But one of the things that I found with the categories this year is that there were quite a lot of like up and coming, really young women who are doing absolutely amazing things, who are probably likely to just go on to snowball and just keep doing more and more really cool stuff. And I know we mentioned it a little bit in last week's podcast, but so for example, the One to Watch Award, there were two winners for it, both of them students, and then the third person who was nominated got a special commendation and then, you know, like an opportunity for work experience. And these are, you know, the people in their teens, they're doing like amazing things, setting up code clubs for other people and leading, you know, like coding and computing workshops to encourage other people like them into STEM careers. They've not even really started their STEM careers yet, and I just find that, you know, like really, really incredible. And one of the interesting categories that I always keep an eye on is the male agent of change, because there's, you know, like this opinion that we can't get real equality unless the people who are actually in charge of everything are involved in it, and that is going to be the men's.
Yeah.
So they name, you know, like a man every year that's been doing above and beyond to try and get equality, like in teams and in firms and stuff like that. So I think that's really cool as well.
Who was that this year?
So this guy was called Duncan Greenwood. He's the vice president and general manager for NEMEA at VMware. So yeah, he's responsible for diversity inclusion in his role across EMEA. So he's been looking to make things a little bit better. I think he sponsors unconscious bias training and reverse mentoring as a way to sort of start tackling the issue of a lack of diversity in firms as well. There were a lot of nominees for Male Agent of Change this year. Yeah, I can't remember the exact number, but I think it was around between 6 and 8, I think.
Okay, yeah.
Like nominees for Male Agent of Change, which I thought was quite interesting.
Mm.
Mm. Yeah, interesting, really important.
Mm.
I was speaking to the lady from Oracle I mentioned a couple of podcasts ago, and she was saying that she thought, in her view, Oracle's actually quite good on diversity.
Mm.
And she said the reason for that is we're quite an established company. So we have a lot of like middle-aged execs, men who have daughters.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And that does seem to make a bit of a difference.
Yeah, it does. I think if you're a guy that has a daughter, you suddenly start to think of things in a different way. Because
yeah.
if you're thinking about like their schooling and their life and their careers and where they're going to go, you start to suddenly realise that it's not quite the same for them as it might have been for you. Even if you think of it as, because that's obviously, you know, like at least 20 years on from where you did it, but
mm-hmm.
then also because it can be a bit tougher.
But you can also see as well, maybe from their point of view, like if you're like, there's, you know, lots of reports about things that happen at events that maybe like
mm-hmm.
put women off entering the, you know, lots of industries, not just tech, but you just kind of think, well, if you're there witnessing that and you think, oh my god, like,
mm-hmm.
imagine if like that happened to my daughter, and it's
mm-hmm.
like, well, I need, you know, that can maybe make them think, right, things need to be done differently,
mm-hmm.
In lots of different ways, I think.
Yeah, and if you have a platform already, then
yeah.
why not use it to make things better for the next people coming up, and then your daughter benefits, it's all good. Yeah.
Mm. Thanks so much for that, Claire.
You're welcome.
My diary next week is full of telephone calls.
Yeah, so is mine. Through lots of Skype and Zoom sort of invitations, sort of like, yeah, we'll just, you know, we'll dial into this from from home.
Mm.
And I think that'll be the norm for a little while yet. So.
Yeah, I'm going to be going to the theatre.
Oh,
when?
Yeah.
But on Thursday next week, I don't know if it...
I said,
is life cancelled? I don't know.
Well, I don't know.
Cancelled
seem to happen
yeah.
just very suddenly. Like
mm.
the whole, like just before we came in here, obviously all the announcements about like, the Premier League being cancelled
mm-hmm.
tomorrow.
Yeah.
And stuff like
so
that.
So short notice.
If we were in Paris, the theatres are closed now.
I know. Yeah.
I think
mm.
they are closed now.
Yeah,
I feel like they are in some cities in the US as well.
Yeah. There's lots of stand-up comedians online making pretty much the same joke that, like, in Scotland, what's it? It's the ban on gatherings of, like, over 100 people.
Inside.
And they're like, well, you know, they sell out that number, so, you know, my show's still going ahead. And stuff. So,
yeah.
But, yeah.
There is that. But theatres pack in
yeah.
quite a lot of seats, don't they?
Yeah, and, like, really, really high up as well, so someone coughs. Up
yeah, just
in
spray
the rafters,
it over
yeah, that's quite dangerous.
Yeah, and very often quite packed in together too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we'll probably do our podcast remotely.
Yeah, for the next couple of weeks, definitely.
Have a go.
Yeah,
how that works.
But it might be the last one for a long time, so you
yeah.
can't get it to work.
This could be the last time that we meet face to face on the podcast for a wee while.
Mm.
Mm.
We'll see.
Some of us will be singing our little heart out tonight.
Mm-hmm. Looking
forward
to it. I have my set list. I'm determined to get through it in the allotted time.
Will there be room for anyone else to sing?
Did it sound like it? No.
Do you want to harmonise?
Yeah,
I
she might
try.
Need backing
yeah.
singers. You should do auditions while you're in the pub, like who's worthy, who's not.
Yeah.
I think you have to have the Beyonce test as well. Like, obviously, if it's your song, if the other person tries to upstage you, just get them out of the band.
Yeah,
like, just
exactly.
removed
gone
from the performance.
Out.
So you're like a soprano or something?
I have no idea.
Claire, you got, because voices are categorised, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
I'm untrained,
yeah.
so I have no idea.
She's just instinctive.
Yeah.
She doesn't have labels.
I was born with it.
Yeah, exactly.
I did get a grade one in singing at some point in my life.
Oh, right.
I always tell people, because I played piano and I played clarinet, and
mm-hmm.
I got to grade 5 in both.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get to grade 8, you're considered professional. So I was telling
really?
Them I'm semi, like, a
semi-professional,
pro.
Yeah.
yeah. so yeah. I'm
yeah.
not, but yeah.
So yeah, I did grade 1 and then quit.
The game didn't need you. Like, you
yeah,
just
exactly.
quit the game before the game quit you.
Teach myself.
Yeah.
Don't need this.
I think that's all we have time for this week. Just Marines for me to say, as usual, thank you very much indeed to Caroline.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much to Claire.
Anytime.
And thank you to you for listening. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.